You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 8th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visits China again for lack of other options. India and Pakistan think of something they haven't already squabbled about. And do voters actually care about celebrity endorsements? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Attica Raymond and James Rogers will discuss the day's big stories, and we'll visit that part of Ukraine which is forever Sweden. At least the flags are the same colours. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller and I'm joined today by Attica Raymond, UK correspondent for Dawn, the Pakistani English language newspaper, and by James Rogers, Associate Professor of International Journalism at City University of London, former BBC Moscow correspondent. Hello to you both.
Hi, Andrew.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Attica, you were in Pakistan as recently as the elections in February. Pakistan is a subject we will be coming to later in the show. How did that look up close as a phenomenon? Because it got a bit lost amid the great democratic hurly-burly of 2024, but it was in its way quite a crucial election.
Yes, it was fascinating to be there because I got to see firsthand the kind of support there is this idea that Imran Khan, who is now, you know, still in jail, who's the former prime minister of Pakistan, there is this idea that he's only supported by young people. Mm. But on the ground, young, old, men, women, children, they were very supportive of him. And they came out in huge numbers to vote for him, despite the fact that his party has been kept out of politics. It's been, you know, blacked out on the media. He's been in jail for many, many months now. So it was really heartening to see that democracy is alive. Even though the results of the election didn't entirely go his way, and there's, you know, allegations that it was totally manipulated.
James, you have recently been to Germany, which will not be coming up so much in the show, though we will be prevailing heavily upon your Russia expertise. You went by train, which is more doable than that might sound.
It is, Andrew. I've tried as much, so not just for environmental reasons, but simply because I actually prefer travelling by train where it's possible within Europe these days. I went to Paris. It takes about 2.5 hours from London by the time you've gone through the border controls, and then changed stations there and 3 hours to the town I was visiting in Western Germany. So it was really good. And you know what? I find short-haul travel in Europe a real headache these days by plane. So it was really nice to find another way to do it.
Short-haul plane travel, rather, in Europe has become mildly less comfortable and pleasant than being dragged behind a bolting quarter horse. And I say this as somebody who is looking forward to doing that as soon as tomorrow. But we will start today's show with the latest peregrinations of Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. For obvious reasons, his options for official visits overseas have become somewhat circumscribed in the last couple of years, but one country which remains willing to kick the red carpet in the direction of his aircraft is China. Lavrov is in Beijing now, meeting his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi. China and Russia have grown ostensibly closer since Russia burned all its other bridges by invading Ukraine, though suspicions have been voiced by reasonable people that Russia is more invested in the relationship than China is. James, and this is, as foreshadowed, where we prevail upon your Russia expertise, is there a level here at which we think Lavrov is sort of reporting to headquarters to be issued with instructions?
No, I don't think we're quite there yet. We may be in the future, though, because if we think about this, I mean, the Chinese continuing purchase of oil is one of the things that's keeping the Russian war economy afloat. And in preparation for our discussion today, I looked up some of the trade figures between Russia and China last year. $240 billion worth of trade in 2023, up 26%. Chinese exports to Russia up 46.9%. So you can see where that trade has been lost with the European Union in particular, which was Russia's largest trading partner, and other countries of the world that have placed extra financial sanctions on Russia since the escalation of the war in Ukraine. China is a very, very important part of that. But to answer your original question, there are analysts who see that this longer-term relationship is going to leave the Russian economy much more dependent on China than it was before. And obviously, it's China, one would imagine, is always going to be a significantly larger economy than Russia.
Artika, by way of demonstrating that dependence, famously, Vladimir Putin visited Beijing very shortly before launching Russia's onslaught in Ukraine. One senses that he pitched Xi Jinping the idea of this lightning 72-hour conquest. It hasn't quite worked out like that, obviously. Do we imagine China's enthusiasm for Russia's adventure in Ukraine is limitless, though? Because if there is one thing we have learnt about what the Chinese Communist Party values, it is stability. And this is the very definition of an unstable situation.
Right. I imagine that the invasion of Ukraine is making China's foreign policy position with Russia pretty awkward. I mean, they're not outrightly condemning Russia, but they're also trying to signal that we're not really militarily aligned when it comes to the invasion. But when I think about their relationship, you're looking at the relationship of, you know, President Xi and Putin, and the fact that they've both on numerous occasions said that they're friendly. But when you look at leaders of the past of both countries, was there that level of friendship and camaraderie? I mean, there is, you know, I was reading something like a report on the in the Council of Foreign Relations saying that there is a historic mistrust between the two. They don't really have engagements when it comes to education or tourism. The businesses on both ends don't quite like to work with each other. So I'm not sure how deep this friendship really goes.
All of which is entirely true. And James, I will throw a variation of that question to you. Why does China actually want to be seen, whether China protests its neutrality or not, and it does, and we should at this point quote Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning, who said, and I quote today, China is not the creator of nor a party to the Ukraine crisis, and we have not and will not do anything to seek profit from it. Why does China want to be seen to be on Russia's side? Because whether China thinks it is on Russia's side or not, that is the perception.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of reasons. I think the energy that we've already discussed is a factor. But I also think it makes China seem like the global power that it is, because, you know, the Chinese have called for talks. They've issued this peace plan. And then after Xi went to Moscow a little over a year ago in March 2023, a few months later, the Financial Times had that story that Xi had told Putin to tone down the rhetoric about using nuclear weapons. And that did seem to happen. This is a personal message. So and we've heard about this no limits partnership, but I think there probably are limits. You know, China has not got suggested any sides, as you've just said, the spokesperson saying there that China is not on any particular side in this, and they have presented this peace plan. But I think, one's reminded of President Biden's prediction that this century is going to be a contest between democracies and autocracies. And clearly, in such a contest, Russia and China would be on the same side.
Just a final thought on this, Artika. If China has seen Russia sort of enmesh itself in a situation by attempting to recapture what it sees as a temporarily rogue province, might they start to realise that maybe it's not as easy as it looks?
Right. No, of course not. I mean, if you look at the global reaction to Russia, that's one thing that China's going to be looking at. I mean, whatever we know about China's position in this world, it's not looking to make enemies when it comes to the trade front. It's still looking to sell its goods into the international market. So I think it's going to take it's going to be taking lessons on what not to do from Russia's playbook, if anything.
Well, let's move along. And almost since Israel commenced its retaliation for the Hamas massacres of October 7th, efforts have been made by Israel's opponents, some acting in better faith than others, to question the legality of Israel's onslaught upon Gaza. South Africa brought a case to the International Court of Justice accusing Israel of genocide, and now Nicaragua has done something similar to Germany, asserting to the ICJ that Germany's considerable sales of military hardware to Israel amount to complicity in genocide. Germany, while so far rising above the obvious retorts about taking instruction in human rights best practices from the regime of Daniel Ortega, nevertheless rejects the charge. James, first of all, it doesn't seem likely, does it, that the ICJ will do as Nicaragua hopes and order Germany, which is Israel's second biggest provider of arms, to cease selling them stuff?
It doesn't, and this is going to be one of those big international court cases where we get a preliminary judgment probably in a matter of weeks, and then a significant judgment may be years down the line. But it is an interesting part of a trend where Israel's critics are seeking the mechanisms of international law such as they exist to try to limit what they're doing. We've also seen in the last week, of course, those four NGOs in Denmark starting legal action against the Danish police and foreign ministry for arms exports to Israel too. So I think this this is probably part of a growing trend. The extent to which it's going to make any difference in the combat zones of the Gaza Strip in the short term, I think, is really, you know, open to debate, to say the least. I mean, I think Israel will presumably blithely disregard pretty much anything apart from what the United States tells it to do. And we do see, of course, tensions developing in that relationship too.
Atika, as we have been reminded over the last 6 months, the conflict at the best of times between Israel and the Palestinians draws in global attention like no other conflict on earth, including many much bigger ones. That being said, is it clear why Nicaragua thinks that this is of enormous importance to Nicaragua and why they need to get involved in this?
I think there's many countries, you know, that feel a solidarity with the Palestinian people. And I would say that Pakistan, for instance, is among them. And, you know, I've had people ask me, say, but why does Pakistan care so much? But you've seen, I mean, there's generations of Nicaraguans and Pakistanis that have seen what is happening in Palestine, whether it's because they are Muslims or because they're a minority, they feel a sort of affinity with the Palestinian people. And I think that the limited images that are coming out of this conflict would move anybody, even if you don't have that affiliation or affinity with the Palestinian people. So it's just a combination of those two things, really.
Is there nevertheless, though, James, an amount of opportunism, arguably, he said about Daniel Ortega, animating this in that Nicaragua understands, as everybody else does, and everybody understands the reasons why genocide, the G word, is a bit of a raw nerve where Germany is concerned?
Yes, of course, and I think there's possibly an element of that too, which is why Germany has been so very quick to deny this, even if they're not directly participating at this stage. But I do think, you know, it is... People around the world are watching this and thinking, what can I actually do about this? And the answer is, in most cases, very, very little. However, I think people are hoping that if there is a sufficient critical mass of these court cases, it may eventually have some sort of influence, even if that is only to reduce the number of people who are being killed on a daily basis. But I think in terms of bringing a solution to the conflict, probably not. But the symbolic value in there, by the more people that get involved in this, that, as I say, may grow that symbolic value.
And that said, is it perhaps counterproductive, Atika, and I'm not actually sure what I think about this myself, in that the genocide tends to get detached from its quite narrow legal meaning. It is a word that means something, and it's used often by people to criticise basically any conflict with which they personally happen to disagree. And my concern is that it allows those countries that may actually be guilty of it or something akin to it to get off the hook by saying, well, no, it's not. And you can't prove that it is.
Right. It is very difficult to prove. But that being said, whether or not Israel's being accused of genocide or anything short of that, it's refuting those allegations. It has shown, like was just said here earlier, that it's not going to take any warnings, any court cases very seriously, and it's going to continue its campaign in Gaza at the cost of civilian lives.
James, I want to come back to your experiences reporting from Gaza as well. At the time you were reporting there, and it was something I noticed in my one very brief visit to Gaza quite a long time ago now, that there was a perhaps over-optimistic, it struck me, view of a lot of people I spoke to about what international public opinion was actually capable of doing in terms of their own situation.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I suspect that's largely evaporated now. I mean, I really do. It's 20 years since I was living there, and times are very different. There was an active peace process, although there was also an active conflict at the same time in the shape of the second Intifada or Palestinian uprising against Israel. But I think that's probably gone. I mean, I think I'm giving way to a large amount of despair. I mean, I was... Yesterday, in the Sunday Times here in London, there was a report on aid workers who are there, obviously in the wake of those who were killed last week. And I saw the name of somebody whom I knew there working for the United Nations when I was there, a man called Sam Rose. And, you know, we knew the same Gaza when I was there. And he said it was literally beyond recognition now. And he said that the territory was back to the Stone Age. Such was the extent of the destruction. So I think if, you know, 20 years ago, and remember that, you know, The Palestinian territories are one of those parts of the world where large majority of the population is under 18. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is not even something that most people will remember that time. So I think I think that time, that belief and trust in international bodies is probably all but evaporated in Gaza in the experience of the last 6 months, I would imagine.
And just finally on this one, Atika, it strikes me that there's another general principle being tested here, or advertently or otherwise, by Nick Uragio, which is the idea of the degree to which any country that sells weapons is ultimately responsible for what they get used for at the other end.
I mean, there is weight to that argument, because we see this conversation happening here in the UK as well.
Mm.
People are all over the world that are opposing what Israel's doing in Gaza, saying stop using our tax money to send weapons or to build weapons to send to these countries. And I think there is a responsibility, especially when you're a state or a country that wields influence and power, like the US, like the UK. I mean, these are the few countries that we hope that Israel will listen to. And I think it's totally fair to ask them to do something like that.
Well, let's move along to a conflict of a different sort entirely. And there are certain foods about which certain nations and certain peoples get both protective and competitive, as will be understood by anybody who has ever absentmindedly asked for a Turkish coffee while in Greece, or unwittingly told a Syrian of their abiding preference for the hummus of Lebanon, or suggested to a New Zealander that the pavlova is an Australian dessert, which it is. A similar row appears to be brewing between India and Pakistan, who have added to their long list of mutual grievances basmati rice. Indian agri-boffins have accused Pakistani farmers of growing strains of basmati to which India holds the copyright. Atika, first of all, would you like to lay down a marker on whose basmati rice is best?
Well, you're challenging my patriotism here, Andrew, so I'm not going to comment on that. But having said that, I mean, we have to break this problem down, right? India and Pakistan don't need very, very many new things to fight over.
So little encouragement is required.
Exactly. Yep. So rice is just the new manifestation of this, historic fight. But really, what's happening is India is accusing Pakistan of what they call seed piracy.
Mm-hmm.
So they're saying that they've taken, Pakistan has taken two very carefully genetically modified varieties of Indian basmati rice and copied them in a lab and is now selling them in the international market. Now, Pakistan is saying, of course, we haven't done that, and allegations of this nature are going to hurt the Pakistani basmati rice in the international market. And Pakistan is hoping for some kind of neutral DNA testing to happen, which will, separate the fact from fiction. Now, the more important thing here is that, why India's rice sales internationally have fallen can depend on various factors. I mean, they're...
Because I rather suspect this is the thing underpinning India's anger, which is that their sales are dropping quite considerably.
Well, absolutely. I mean, rice exports are a huge revenue mm-hmm. generator for India. I think last year they hit nearly, 5 million metric tons of rice exports. But this year, they're forecast to fall. Now, I think what India needs to do is look at the reasons why this is happening. The Indian government had offered some kind of minimum export price, which backfired, and that resulted in Pakistan kind of capturing the market with a very depreciated rupee, so they can, sell it for much cheaper, and it's a more competitive price. But really, I think what both countries need to do more of is look at why they're so focused on basmati rice. Like, there's many other things to sell, but because of their over-reliance on a single product, and even not just a single product, a single strain of that mm-hmm. rice, which is the king of the rice that makes the chicken biryani that we all love to eat. At the risk of this obsession with basmati rice, they're overgrowing the rice, they're using water that they don't have. And because of, climate change and how erratic rainfall has become, those factors also play into fall in production in a country like India. So instead of looking at those things, I think India is, obviously the debate between India and Pakistan always falls into this trap of high decibel warmongering. but really, I think both quarters would do well to really, look at the internal and the external issues that are hurting production. And a lot of the answers lie in over-reliance on a single variety and climate change.
James, would you like to state a preference for Indian or Pakistani basmati rice?
Again, I will decline the opportunity. Thank you very much, Andrew. I am fond of rice.
I have two two guests here who don't want to spend the next month emptying their inboxes.
I also, to be completely honest, suspect I'm not enough of a connoisseur to really express them. But I can't imagine my opinion would be of great value.
Lamentable.
To be quite honest, yeah.
But I should add that if anyone's ever eaten a good quality biryani, mm-hmm. then you can understand the sentiments and the mm-hmm. attachment yeah. to this rice. I mean, it's really a delight to eat.
Oh, it is absolutely that. I don't think anybody's going to quibble with the merits of a good biryani, unless you have an especially trenchant opinion, James.
I don't actually, Andrew. No, I'm quite as fond of a good biryani as the next person.
You speak like a deeply wounded veteran of a hummus war at some point or another, James. You know how much trouble you can get into here. But there is, you know, as Attika has just been delineating, it is a serious thing that serious people are taking seriously. India has a case before the European Commission now over what's called a protected geographical indication. So only Indian basmati rice will be allowed to be called basmati. Do consumers, do you think, actually care about this stuff? I mean, I'm a fairly regular consumer of basmati rice. I don't think I've ever looked at the packet to see where it was grown.
Yeah, I think I'm probably the same. I imagine a lot of consumers are. I mean, I think there are some things that people look out for, you know, and talking about the protected origin rules, they are, you know, a guarantee of quality. And that's, I guess, is why they're worth so much commercially in terms of, you know, goods that are produced in the European Union. But this, you know, as you say, is something that serious people are taking seriously. And this is not just a commercial dispute, it's a cultural dispute, but one that also touches on so many burning international issues like climate change, like international law and breaches thereof, denied in this case, of course. So it is a very, very important issue.
I mean, Attika, just finally on this, and especially given the fact that climate change is a disproportionate menace, I think, to both India and Pakistan, and I realise as I ask it, this is probably an extremely silly question, but I'm going there anyway. Is there really no prospect of a kind of hands across the border moment, even where basmati rice is concerned? Could India and Pakistan not just say, look, whatever else we may disagree on, and there's plenty, on this one thing, this is our mutual gift to the world. This is something we can both work to protect.
Andrew, if only, if only. I think, I mean, it's amazing that you've said this, because if there's one, you know, shared threat and shared challenge mm-hmm. that is not going to wait for either country to get its act together, it's the climate threat. And we're not just talking about rice production and, you know, we're talking about air pollution. We're talking about extreme heat. We're talking about two countries that are not the biggest emitters yet are facing the fallout of a changing climate. And we're talking about developing countries that are now demanding, you know, reparations for loss and damage. But these countries just cannot bring themselves to sit on a table and say, okay, let's just pause the fighting and speak with one voice to demand reparations for climate, you know, damage, for climate change. Unfortunately, both have failed on numerous occasions. A lot of the platforms and the mechanisms that exist for India and Pakistan to collaborate on climate are defunct. The saddest thing is that scientists do not share data. There's no mechanism for them to share weather data, mm-hmm. to share data from the Himalayan watershed where glaciers are melting, you know, that are feeding the rivers that over a billion people rely on. So they have to do it. They can't wait, and it's a question of, you know, how quickly they'll get their act together.
Well, let's move along to a country which cannot even agree with itself. It is 210 days, which are likely to seem longer until the US presidential election. The incumbent Joe Biden is going to have to find a path to victory which does not include, as it did in 2020, the endorsement of Dwayne The Rock Johnson, a former professional wrestler turned star of dreadful movies, whose opinions about anything beyond professional wrestling and dreadful movies are for some reason solicited. Johnson has declared that he will not be endorsing anyone, which is being interpreted in certain excitable quarters as indications that he has ambitions of running for president himself someday, as if American voters would ever entrust their most exalted office to a professional blowhard whose qualifications amount to appearing in tacky television programs aimed at the hard of thinking. James, can Joe Biden survive this? Can he overcome the non-endorsement of Dwayne The Rock Johnson?
I think that's one of the questions that's really perplexing Washington's political circles at the moment.
The trouble that it kind
and,
of
know,
is
speaking of those TV programmes, I had, did actually watch The Rock on TV just a couple of weeks ago. Unwittingly, I have to say, pining for the start of the cricket season here, I watched some cricket from another part of the world, Bangladesh against Sri Lanka, to be precise, which was followed by a wrestling programme. And I was surprised to see The Rock. I don't follow wrestling that closely. You know I'm quite a sports fan, but I don't follow wrestling that closely. But it wasn't actually a fight. It was The Rock making a song, playing, performing a song about some of his former rivals to a massive stadium waiting for the wrestling to start. So he's obviously still, you know, got sway over certain sections of public opinion. And so I would imagine the president probably is slightly, but he would rather, I mean, he'd rather have had his endorsement than not. Let's put it that way, I imagine.
Well, I'm sure. What we were trying to figure out here, you know, having now solved India, Pakistan, the Middle East and Ukraine, Russia in one eventful programme, Attica, was whether celebrity endorsements do actually make any difference. Are they, for example, a feature of Pakistani elections?
No, they absolutely do make a difference. It depends on which country you're talking about. Mm-hmm. In Pakistan, it matters more who the military is siding with. So let's not go there.
That's a celebrity endorsement of a sort, I guess.
Exactly. But, I mean, in the US, where, I mean, a lot of people are voting for the first time, you have young voters, you have people who are feeling very disillusioned with Biden and the Biden administration. And here you have someone like The Rock, who has millions of followers on his social platform, saying that he's not going to endorse a candidate. I can imagine that people, young people especially, who are not getting their news from mainstream news websites and newspapers, they're getting their news from TikTok and Instagram. Yeah. Of course it would make them think twice.
There is genuine anguish and conjecture and energy being expended in Washington, James, about whether or not Taylor Swift will endorse a presidential candidate. I think we can rule out her endorsing Trump. Don't really see her as an RFK Jr. type. So it would be Biden again, who she did endorse in 2020. But enormous amounts of concern are being expended on this. People do seem to think she could actually tip the balance, possibly. One, do you think that's true? And two, if it is it in fact time to rethink the disastrous Democratic experiment?
I would imagine it would be influential. I mean, you know, for the reason that Artica's just been pointing out, you know, with the young people who are massively engaged in the media, but not what one might call the mainstream media. And so this is where they do get their news from TikTok and other social media platforms. And they, you know, they do follow Taylor Swift in large numbers and go to her concerts and buy her records. So I would imagine it could have an influence. Whether it's going to be decisive, that's probably one for sociologists and pollsters to work out after the fact. But given that we're talking about this very small number of swing states, if her endorsement had an influence there, then one could argue it has an influence on the general election as a whole.
Attica, according to a recent poll, fully 18% of Americans believe that possibly Taylor Swift's entire career, certainly her recent romance with Travis Kelce, star tight end of the Kansas City Chiefs, are in fact a psyops conspiracy to tip the election for the Democrats.
I mean,
that's not really a question, it is more of a comment.
I can't wait for the post-election analysis that reads how Taylor Swift destroyed the Democratic Party. You know, like how, if she doesn't end up endorsing it, I mean, that is something to unpack.
Just a final thought on this, James. Is there any hope at all, do you think, at any future juncture that we might approach a critical mass of this sort of nonsense and come out the other side of it and have a plurality of voters understanding that politics and entertainment are not supposed to be the same thing?
Well, yeah, but I mean, America's got a long and proud history of that. I mean, remember, Ronald Reagan started out as a movie actor, not a particularly successful one, and has gone down in history as the president who helped to end the Cold War. So make of that what you will.
Well, on that ambiguous note, James Rogers and Attica Raymond, thank you both for joining us. Finally, on today's show, Ukraine might seem an unlikely location for a Swedish village, Ukraine not being Sweden. But the residents of Gammelsvenskby are proud of their heritage. To find out more about the history of the settlement, Xander Brett spoke to Sophia Hoas, who helps organise aid efforts in the village. He also spoke to Larissa Bailey, who grew up in the town but who has sought refuge in Sweden as Russia's invasion wears on.
Deep in southeastern Ukraine, there's a village with Swedish heritage. Gammelsvenskby was founded thanks to Catherine the Great's relocation efforts in the 1700s when Russia took control of an island that now lies in present-day Estonia. keen to populate other areas of her empire, a collection of Estonian Swedes trekked overland to the banks of the River Dnipro. Sophia Hus, who works for an association that celebrates the history of Gammelsvensby, says there's still one lady in the village who speaks a dialect of Swedish called Gammelsvenska. Sophia can follow the language and says there were also about 20 residents who could speak modern Swedish.
It's not similar, but I can understand it. It's other words and another melody. My relatives also spoke it. My grandfather and grandmother spoke it.
Sophia's grandparents fled the village in 1929 during Stalinist rule. They were part of relocation efforts that saw hundreds of villagers move to Sweden and a handful to Canada.
In 1929, the entire village fled, about 900 persons that was coming to Sweden by then. But then 250 returned to the Soviet Union. And since the war 2014 or 2022, most of the villages fled. It's just 100 left from 2,300 people. And we have about 50 or 60 in Sweden.
Larissa Belle grew up in Gammelsvensby and now teaches Swedish to Ukrainians in Stockholm. She and her two sons fled Gammelsvensby during the war, but her husband was killed in the village last year.
I lived in the occupation 3 months and then I couldn't stand anymore and I left in June 2022. I saw Russians, I saw bombings, I felt what is hunger is, and we stood in the long queue to get one loaf of bread for the whole family, and we divided it into pieces. It was awful.
Sophia Hus.
Before the war, there was not that many that knew about this village, and now it's a great interest in Sweden because it's a very unique history. We don't have colonies like that, so this is the only village that we have this connection with.
In Russia's sham referendums in September 2022, extraordinary stories of bravery emerged from Gammelsvensby. Residents reportedly locked themselves in their homes, and Sophia says they let their dogs out to, as she put it, let their dogs speak for them.
Lina Knutas, my friend down there, she went out in the garden and told the Russian soldiers that I won't not vote at all. Then the Russian soldiers said to her, then we'll shoot your dog. And Nina said, this is Ukraine and this is my land. If you shoot my dog, I will strangle you with my bare hands. So then they had lowering their weapons and went away.
Gammelsvensby was occupied by Russian forces from March to the 11th of November 2022. But even when the troops had gone, the bombing continued.
The Russian army is still on the other side of the river, so they are just 4 kilometers from the village. And the entire village is more or less destroyed today.
Larissa Belle.
I couldn't go to work when I got the picture of the village and my house. I stayed at home. I couldn't get up from the bed. And I don't know if I have got now forces to come back to see everything. I hope it will be rebuilt. I hope people will have opportunity to come back, the people who are able, who want to come back and to continue living here and enjoy the place, because it's really unique place in Ukraine.
Sophia Hus visited Gammelsvensby about 20 times before the full-scale invasion. Now she, like Larissa, is barred from returning there while the war is ongoing.
When we are doing the aid work, we have to stay about 20 kilometers from the village. Sven Bjerlestam, he's normally living in Ukraine. He's a Swede from the beginning, but started to work there in 1995. Now he fled the war, but he has been driven down 8 times during 23.
The ruined village is certainly a far cry from life in Gammelsvensby before the conflict. There is a Belay again.
We had 2 schools, 2 kindergartens, Orthodox Church, Greek Catholic Church, and Protestant Church. Baths and even restaurants, a lot of shops and even marketplace. There were a lot of concerts. People who lived in the village, they gathered together to sing, to dance. And it is very suitable. The place is very suitable to grow vegetables and fruits and flowers. And this is the place where I was born. This is the place where I grew up. This is the place where I met my love. The people who lived there, they are very hardworking, open-hearted, helpful. The houses we lived in were always so nice and clean, and the kitchen gardens, the roses and the flowers were so, they were fantastic.
Sophia Huis again.
In the village, we can't connect to people any longer because there's no internet and no phone lines anymore. But we can speak to those in the neighboring villages and mostly through text messages. But we can also call them sometimes.
Communication will be essential as the residents of Gammelsvensby already look to rebuild their settlement when the war is over. A modern village, they hope, will emerge from the rubble. But a village that holds on and maintains its seemingly unlikely Swedish heritage.
Sander Brett with that report for Monocle Radio. And that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Attica Raymond and James Rogers. Today's show was produced by Tom Webb and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Tamsin Howard. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.